God! Where in the world did you learn that?
My age, technique is everything.
Oh, technique.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week, we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. Hi, I'm Patrick Randall.
I'm Matt Dominguez.
This episode is called Priorities, Please. Beat the Time. It's number 10 in season 2 of Queer as Folk.
It first aired in the U.S. on March 17th, 2002.
It was directed by Michael DiCarlo. He directed 11 Queer as Folk episodes. We've tended to like his work.
Priorities, Please. Beat the Time. It's a mouthful, I feel. Was written by Ron Cohen and Daniel Lipman, and the teleplay was written by Matt Pikin and Michael Burns. Pikin and Burns wrote 5 episodes of Queer as Folk, and this is their second. They also co-produced 20 episodes of the show. Pikin produced shows such as Mr. Robot, which Randy Harrison also appeared in, and Michael Burns was a consulting producer on Kyle XY. I feel like Kyle XY has come up a lot as we've done this show.
I keep writing it into the notes, but I've never watched it yet, so
is
I
it
need
streaming?
To check that out. I'm not sure. We'll have to find out. That could be a podcast in itself, but I know nothing of the show, so maybe it couldn't be a podcast in itself. The Showtime synopsis for Priorities, Please, Beat the Time. As Michael mourns the death of his favorite comic book superhero, Debbie discovers a real-life murder victim. Emmett helps George to have fun. And Melanie and Lindsay find inspiration in the pages of Grandmother's Secret Letters.
IMDb synopsis. Debbie finds a dead body in the diner's dumpster. Michael is more upset when his favorite comic book hero dies. George and Emmett get closer. And no mention of Melanie and Lindsay at all. Even though I feel like their storyline was rather critical to this episode.
I did like the Showtime synopsis where it had Debbie discovers a real-life murder victim because Sharon Glass was in Cagney and Lacey, detective thriller back from the 80s? 80s or 90s?
Yeah, I think 80s, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and she was on, she had a guest spot on Nip Tuck where I think she was a psycho.
Ooh,
it just reminds
that'd be
me
good.
Of that. Oh, you should watch it.
There's going to be a Cagney and Lacey reboot.
They're rebooting everything. And as I've seen on some of our comments on our Facebook page, I think we have a lot of fans who'd be interested in a Queer as Folk reboot too. But I don't know what they would do with it.
Yeah, Brian Kinney as George Schickel. No, George died in a plane.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, shit. Yeah. We're assuming that you've watched all these already. Hypothetically, George died in a tragic plane crash.
Plane incident. How about that?
This episode finally had a proper lesbian story, and I gave it the A story in this episode. So Melanie and Lindsay are planning their wedding.
And it's, you know, they're doing the tasting, which seems
is
already...
that a thing? Is that how you do that?
Yeah.
You like show up and they have like the meals laid out that you pick on a per person?
I wouldn't say they would have had it laid out the way Mel and Lindsay had it, where it was literally different place settings. Usually they like bring out the plates. At least that's
do you
what
get
I
to eat
see.
It? Taste
well,
it?
Well, yeah, you have to taste it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. At least I know that to be the case when it comes to cakes. But here it was like they were trying out the whole meal.
This is our plat bleu spécial. Pain de viande, purée de pommes de terre and de sauce rouge relevée pour la salade.
Translation, blue plate special. Meatloaf, mashed potatoes and iceberg lettuce with Russian dressing.
Next, le menu parisien.
Ouh là là.
Canard royal, soufflé de fromage impérial and tarte framboise à la reine.
So, how much for Marie Antoinette's last meal?
50.
Let them eat wedding cake.
What's that?
That is our cornucopia d'or, the feast of feasts. New Zealand filet mignon and African lobster.
How much?
$125.
For surf and turf?
Is that how much a wedding costs?
Oh, yeah. Shit. A wedding, well, depending, obviously, on what you get, a wedding is hella expensive.
We have a mutual friend that is about to get married in June. I wonder how much they're spending. He did say that they have a whole, like, hotel reserved for people that are showing up. And this wedding's just outside of Chicago. So I said, well, why wouldn't I just drive home? And he said, well, you plan on getting shit-faced, right? And I said, no. Says, okay, well, no hotel room for Patrick Randall. Okay, got it.
That's very true. Depending on where the wedding is, that's where you kind of depend on whether or not you get the room in one of the blocks of hotels that they have.
Does this involve like one of those trolleys where the entire wedding party is being driven around in the trolley?
That's usually, I think, reserved for like the bachelor, bachelorette party.
Okay.
I mean, the bachelor party that I experienced last year, we took an Uber to our destination.
That's more my speed.
Yes. Then again, we also went to Medieval Times out in the suburbs and it was amazing.
Oh, that's a great place for a wedding.
It was awesome for the bachelor party.
I root for the Green Knight.
We were the black and white night.
Ah.
It was great.
So Mel and Lynn's still appear broke, which again, here's some sloppy writing that I just keep bumping on every time where Melanie is always complaining to Lindsay that Lindsay is a spoiled little rich girl.
I'm sorry if you feel that all I care about is money, but I didn't grow up a spoiled little rich girl like you.
I am not a spoiled little rich girl.
Please. Your entire world view is based on Santa bringing you everything you ever asked for.
He didn't bring me everything I asked for.
Melanie's a partner in a law firm, so her affluence is surely growing. She's made comments in the past about having well-to-do parents who cut her off from her college fund. So it seems a little disingenuous that Melanie's often complaining about Lindsay having money when it seems like she comes from money in the first place. So I didn't quite track with that one.
I would agree with that to an extent, because I feel like maybe Melanie is not quite as affluent or comes from as a well-to-do family as Lindsay does, as we know, and as we've seen with Lindsay's sister and the weddings
yeah.
that she has had, that clearly there's like mansion level money happening in Lindsay's family. And I don't know. I think Melanie obviously was comfortable, but I don't think she was as well to do. And that's why she's probably a bit more realistic in trying to keep things under control. You know, because as we've seen, Lindsay wants this to be an extravagant wedding. And I get that in her mind, it's their one day and it's their special day. And I'm understanding that argument, but there's also a point where you have to sort of be realistic because she's not getting the help from her parents as much as she has tried to ask. So I think that's all Melanie's trying to do. But then, yeah, she kind of comes out and spits at her.
Well, how many people need to go to this wedding? Like, if you're going to spend $125 for your wedding, how many people are you going to invite?
I feel like there are two separate lists happening with them. There's the Melanie list that maybe has 20 people, and there's the Lindsay list that has like 250.
So is this like a $10,000 wedding, or is this like north of that?
To be honest, that's probably on the cheap side when it comes to weddings.
Oh my God.
Right? Exactly. The amount of money that can go into a wedding is absolutely insane.
We did get to see a dyke bar scene in this episode, which normally in the past, we've seen the gay male bars transformed into dyke night. This was a proper dyke bar. So that was nice to see.
Yes. The lesbians in their natural habitat. It's pretty great.
There's a hot little scene of Lita kind of acting like Brian, prowling around the dyke bar and just like picking up tricks.
I was like, I didn't even know who that woman was when the battle between Melanie and Lindsay was ending,
mm-hmm.
because she seemed to be part of the conversation, but I was like, wait, who are you? I was like, that's Lita, and I understand why she's here, but why were you invited into the picture? And then I said, like, oh, you're just the woman that Lita's going to go after tonight.
Interestingly enough, as Mel and Lynn's stomped out of the bar, Lita was left with that woman, and they kind of made sexy eyes at each other, and then the woman goes in, we think we're going to get a kiss. They didn't kiss. The woman just kind of veered off to the side.
It lingered. That's what it did.
Yeah, I don't know. I just thought that those two dykes should have gone for it. It's like, get those tongues out.
Because let's be honest, that it happens quite often in this show that Mel and Lindsay have some of the more aggressive graphic sex scenes. So to show the Lita hooking up with this woman would not have been outside the realm of possibility.
Yeah, in the last episode, Melanie was talking about how their pussies drip so much that they soak the sheets.
Just for your information, Lindsay and I fuck like crazy. We pant and drool like a couple of bitches in heat. Our pussies soak the sheets.
Jeez.
Yeah, I was just editing that episode tonight.
That's an image that's going to stay with you forever, Patrick.
Oh, it did. The next morning, Mel and Lynn's are having a bitchy lesbian breakfast. It was great.
I described this as increasing levels of petty happening.
Fighting over the arts and leisure section. Neither of them are answering the phone. It was this nice little passive aggressive back and forth between the two.
And absolutely not subtle at all.
I didn't think it was interesting that Lindsay accused Melanie of not reading the arts and leisure section for like 10 years or whatever. It's like, surely she picked it up at least once, right?
Right. It goes back into that argument that somehow Lindsay may be more cultured than Mel. And Mel is the more down to earth and, you know, showing that there are two distinct kinds of lesbians.
Yeah. The Granny Faye wedding dress seemed to really weigh heavily on Lindsay. And I started to look at that through the lens of the Love Shack MDMA party that happened a few episodes ago.
Oh, yes.
Where she basically told her parents, fuck off. I don't need you. I don't need to be part of your world. But then, like, she kind of wanted back into that world. So I just kind of bumped on that and just wondered if she really wanted out, like, all the way out. How does the dress get an exception to that?
I can see your point, because I feel like part of the reason why Lindsay wants such an extravagant wedding is because of a lifestyle in which she had become accustomed and the what she gets from her sister. So it feels like she's trying to get everything at the same level. I think at this point, even the wedding dress comes into play.
Well, it shouldn't have been a surprise that her mother said, no fucking way, after the way that she acted at the party, though, right?
And also how her mother clearly thinks of their relationship. Her mom has never made this a secret. So I don't know what Lindsay thought. Isn't this kind of part of like how you would describe chaos? Is the same thing happening, but expecting different results?
Yeah, that's one way to think about it. But you would think in an episodic TV show, they'd at least have some continuity with that. It's insanity, like not chaos.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, insanity. Yeah. Yes. Insanity is.
I couldn't think of it at first.
Thank you. I was like, I feel like I know this saying somewhere. So,
well,
yes.
The insanity part is next because they break into the house. So I just envisioned the two lesbians like finding a ladder out in the back and tilting it up against the attic and climbing in to get the wedding dress.
Lindsay says she has a key. So is it really breaking and entering? I was like, in the event that the police were called, I feel like Lindsay would have quite a good argument. Like, I have keys.
There was a sloppy bit in the story here that I didn't like at all, which I understand why it was there. And it was designed to imbibe the waspy nature of Lindsay's life and her family life. When she says that they came over on the Mayflower. So I looked this up. There were 100 people on the Mayflower. Half of them died within a month of landing. And it just seemed like stupid. It's like, yes, we know they're waspish. Yes, we know that they have pedigree.
But they have to be like the wasp of the wasp.
Yeah, well,
they're not even the 1%. They're the 0.01%.
The pilgrims weren't all that waspy either. They were like fighting for dear life for like 100 years. They're all dying. They're being attacked. They were being killed by disease. So it's like, well, couldn't you have like thought of something better? Like, we came over in the time of Queen Victoria or something like that, not like 200 years prior.
It's as if, because this show is, you know, has such strong Canadian ties, they're like, they had to like, we had to give something for the Americans to really latch onto. And what does everyone know? The Mayflower.
Yeah.
Because we know that America is real shit when it comes to our history. But I guess if there's one thing we can all rely on is that we all know the freaking Mayflower.
Melanie had some really funny and really biting sarcastic lines. It just came off as just cunty and mean to Lindsay, though. Melanie was just ribbing her about her family history. And honestly, Lindsay didn't really have anything to do with that, or her history. You know, she was born. You know, so she couldn't help that Granny Faye, Great Granny Faye, or whoever the hell
Granny
it was,
Faye, yes.
Came over on the Mayflower. I don't think Granny Faye did, but.
The lineage of Granny Faye.
Yeah. And of course, the dress is missing, though. Who saw that coming? I did.
Everyone.
So in the chest, we find something better than the wedding dress.
Which, before we get into this,
where'd the dress go?
I thought, no, as soon as they pull out these letters, I'm thinking, oh, wouldn't it be funny if, and as the scene progresses, I was like, oh, I'm right.
Oh, wait, you haven't seen this episode before? Were you watching it for the first time?
I mean, as we've mentioned before, it's been years since I've watched this series. So I'm sure at some point I saw this, but because it's been so long,
so
and
you
it's
didn't
been
know
such
it was
a
in the letters then.
Yeah. So it was so I have very interesting thoughts about it as we go through this.
Well, you didn't know about the letters. Did Lindsay's parents? They were in this chest. So it was like, didn't her parents already know that Granny Faye and Vera were two dykes?
So part of me wants to say that they didn't know, because if they had, I feel like Lindsay's parents are the kind of people that would burn the letters.
Exactly. You wouldn't think that they'd keep them.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think they knew about the dress and were dealing with that and trying to hide it from Lindsay. But the letters was an oversight there.
Well, maybe we can think of it like this. Let's try to explain this gap in the story.
Okay. Let's fill the plot hole.
Yeah. will retrospectively fill it. So Lindsay asks for the dress. Her mother says no. They come and break into the house. The dress is gone. I guess that Lindsay's mother could have ran upstairs, grabbed the dress, and burned the dress and just grabbed it out of the trunk, not realizing what was under the dress, which was the letters, because they never looked under the dress.
I would hate to think that she burned the dress, but...
Well, she hid it.
Yes, she hid it or moved it from where it was in order to keep Lindsay from getting her lesbian hands on it.
You'd still think that such a deep, dark family secret like that, somebody had to know, right? Could Granny Faye and Vera have kept it to themselves that long and nobody else knew, but they had several dozen letters that...
We know. It's always interesting to me.
Where are the Snoopy grandchildren?
Well, Lindsay's one of them.
That's true.
I find it fascinating looking into the history of queer culture and seeing what was actually very out in the open compared to what was incredibly well hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And when you discover who really knew when and who managed to keep it such a quiet secret for so long, I find that really interesting. So for all we know, maybe they were two people who managed to hide it incredibly well. Honestly, what if Faye and Vera are like the movie Carol from a couple years ago? Which, if you haven't seen Carol, watch Carol.
Well, Melanie had a pretty prescient thought when she said,
"Times were different then. It's what women had to do. They had no choice."
So I like that there was at least an attempt at an explanation of why this didn't happen, why it fell apart, why nobody knew about it until decades later when Lindsay finds all these letters. I did like how Michael DiCarlo shot this. He's alternating between shots of Melanie and Lindsay. And we know that these two women do have choices now and that there is still a ways to go. But that moment between them was enough to solve their wedding planning problems just because they realized, hey, Granny Faye and Vera never had this opportunity. We've got this opportunity and we're bickering over the surf and turf or the hamburger sliders.
When her grandmother had to likely stay away and build a family based on a lie for over 50 years. This whole storyline with Granny Faye, I found rather heartbreaking and also very beautiful in a way to create the through line of, we've watched them fight over this petty bullshit with their wedding, but to say, as they read these letters, they get to have
Yeah, we can do better.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of didn't like the way that this scene was stitched up. I like the overall story, so I'm really just talking about the stagecraft of it. There was this final letter.
There's one more letter. It's never been opened.
So they're going to read it together, but the way that the scene was shot, it seemed like Lindsay already had an idea what was in that letter. It seemed like she had already read it.
It's dated March 10th, 1994.
So?
Granny Faye died in 1992.
She never got to read it.
Or know that Vera always loved her.
It just seemed a little awkward the way it was staged.
I wouldn't, maybe it was how it was staged, but I guess I didn't think of it that way. I was thinking about how they were processing the information and that Lindsay was able to see the date and immediately clock it and that it is.
So maybe she did read it and.
Yes.
Okay.
And then like, let's have Melanie have that moment. And
okay,
then,
I like
and then
that.
Lindsay almost has to kind of break a moment. Mm-hmm. What we think is really beautiful and really touching and could have meant something is then to discover the tragedy of it all.
Yeah. I like the story and I like the way that it played out, but can you imagine being married for 50 years to somebody of the opposite sex that you're not attracted to and like having children? 50 fucking years?
There are people who have done it.
It just seemed, well, okay, yeah. In the recent past, I think now it's just implausible because can somebody really go 50 years hiding their true self? That's hard.
There, I will
Don't
say-
Don't you get a whiff? We have gaydar.
I will say there are people who are on that path today, and it is just as sad when you think we are at probably what would be the most accepting time that they still feel the need that they have to hide themselves or somehow try to change themselves.
Yeah, I guess there's a difference between not fully understanding and processing who you are until later in life versus knowing that at an early age and not doing anything about it.
I mean, it's...
Because Granny Faye and Vera, they knew they were dykes. They got it. They understood it.
Would you say that they knew that they understood that label or that they knew that they just understood...
They were making love on a beach.
So they... Well, and that's what I'm saying is that back then, did they necessarily have have the label that they were lesbians.
Oh, well.
Or that they were gay. All they probably understood is that they have the feelings for each other and not a man.
Yeah, it probably wasn't as much of a cultivated thought as it is now, because nowadays kids are exposed to this at a much earlier age. They have time to synthesize it and make a decision around it. Not so much a decision, but a realization around it.
They're able to classify it. Maybe that's
right.
That there is at least something, there is something tangible about what's going on with them.
The story was just so cute and I liked it. I guess I just needed to roll with it a little bit more instead of trying to take apart the episode. But that final letter really did the trick for Melanie.
I'm suddenly in the mood for surf and turf.
You are?
I say we go for the cornucopia door.
It's wildly extravagant. It'll probably land us in the poorhouse.
It's our special day. Besides, Granny Faye and Vera would have wanted us to.
She realized that this was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime thing and that the $125 plate of surf and turf was going to be well worth it.
It would have been nice if Lindsay then could have said, what really matters is that we're together. And that way you could have had like an O. Henry moment.
Yeah.
Yes, you can have the $125 plate. Oh, but the $125 doesn't matter. Like, that would have been nice.
Right.
But it's fine. As long as Lindsay gets what she wants.
We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about Emmett and George.
We're hoping for sponsorship from Schickel's Pickles, so make sure to subscribe and rate us on iTunes.
Still, queer as folk. So the B story that we had here is Emmett and George Schickel. Apparently, Emmett and George have moved on to hooking up, and apparently George is quite the cocksucker.
Oh, God! Where in the world did you learn that?
My age, technique is everything.
Oh, technique. I would call that art. Oh, that was the best oral sex I have ever had.
Like, damn.
I think in my entire, career, my entire oeuvre of experiences, I don't think that I've ever had a situation where somebody's blown me to the level that I think it's like the best thing ever. It's like, all right, thank you.
Oh, I wonder if we will have some listeners who disagree with that, Patrick.
Well, I mean, the way that Emmett was putting it, it was like the end of the earth. Like the ground shook, volcanoes opened.
I definitely have a ranking.
And George swallowed.
Because spitters are quitters. Sometimes I wonder, it could be just that it was the throes of passion that Emmett felt that way, because we know Emmett has had experiences.
Oh, yes. He's a porn star.
Exactly. So he...
Solo porn star, but nevertheless.
Still a porn star.
Yeah.
And so it could be one of those things where it's the throes of passion that he believes he is getting the best he's ever had in that moment.
In the past hour.
In the past 20 minutes.
Past 24 hours. Since that trick last night at Babylon. This story is getting cute between the two of them. This is like a cute episode. It's Granny Faye and Vera and Melanie and Lindsay and Emmett. And George.
It's heartwarming. That's how I think of it. Yeah. Because I think the storyline between George and Emmett is really sweet without being saccharine. Like, I'm not going to get diabetes from it. It's something that I'm finding the development of their relationship, not feeling like it's a gimmick because George is a much older man. I find it really lovely and even quite believable that they have found a connection in an odd sense, like considering that they met because George was a fan of Emmett's porn work.
Yeah. And like tried to prostitute him and gave him a Tiffany and Company bracelet.
Tried to buy his happiness.
A for effort. He won.
But that
he's a winner.
But that they were able to move past that and find deeper connection with each other. And I think as I said, I think it's really quite lovely to watch.
I did love how gutsy Emmett was in taking George out to Babylon. I thought that was great.
Come on.
Well, where are we going?
You are coming with me.
Oh, no. No, I'm not ready. No,
honey, of course you are ready.
No,
you've been ready your entire life. You just didn't know it.
Oh.
Now, come on. Put on your dancing shoes. We are going to Babylon.
Oh, it was, again, so wonderful to watch George then be out at Babylon meeting the guys for the first time.
Yeah. I mean, Emmett could care less about appearances. He was living his best life. He walks in with George and Brian says, Fossil. Justin says, Crypt Keeper. I just loved how George harnessed that inner CEO of a pickle company and just charmed and owned all of them.
Allow me to introduce everyone.
I feel as if I know everybody already. You're Ted, am I correct?
That's right.
The entrepreneur. Fetch and I owe you a debt of gratitude because your website brought us together. And to you, of course, are Michael, the devoted friend.
You told him that?
And Justin, if I'd had your courage when I was your age, how different my life would have been. Oh yeah, Brian. Well, from what Emmett tells me, yeah, you're the love child of James Dean and Ayn Rand.
George, can I buy you a drink?
We came here to dance. Come on, George. Let's boogie.
He knew who they were.
Yeah. He knew who they were within the group. And I love the fact that as he went down the line and just like absolutely nailed the personality of each and every one of them. And Brian was like, George, can I get you a drink?
Yeah.
Like even Brian was charmed by him.
Yeah.
Which was really impressive.
And Emmett just hustles him off right to the dance floor where we find out that neither of them were really great dancers that night.
Doesn't matter. Again, living their best lives. They're with each other.
It was so cute.
I will admit though, I was having a bit of a moment because I know where the George Sickle storyline goes. I thought George Sickle was going to have like a moment as he's like dancing away that he was going to be
what kind of a moment?
Like he was going to be out of breath or that like he needed a moment to sit down.
Oh, he's not
like
that old.
It was going to be too much for him at some point. But I love that he's just like the experience was overwhelming for him in a good way.
I think that only would have happened if he could have managed to dance with his hands over his head, but he didn't. He had him more like at knee level. So for these two, it's off to the opera. And it's interesting that George had become just such a recluse after his forced coming out. You remember that he came out after his wife, Virginia Hammond of Hammond's Ham, found him blowing the gardener.
I wish we had seen the gardener.
We saw the butler. Maybe he graduated from gardener to butler.
Maybe.
So I just thought it was strange that he went into hiding that long ago. You'd think that he would have come out a long time ago because apparently he's been hiring hookers and prostitutes for a while and watching porn on the internet. So.
You would have thought that those kinds of stories would have gotten out in the tabloids, considering he is such a titan of industry.
Yeah, exactly.
And I would not have thought that his wife, who apparently is, or his ex-wife is also a titan of said industry, to have that kind of power to lord over him still. It was very interesting because like he says that she's the gatekeeper of the Sickle Hall.
Right.
That's why he never goes.
I did like that. She was from a pork company and George is the pickle company and together they made great sandwiches. I like that line for some reason. I did notice that there is some great prop work here and you really had to look for it because earlier in the episode when Melanie and Lindsay were bickering at their little breakfast about the arts and leisure section, on the back page of that paper was a full page ad for Aida, which is the opera that George and Emmett went to.
Easter egg.
So it was great heads up work by Tanya Lemke. She was the property supervisor on the show and worked on 42 episodes.
Snaps for Tanya.
I really liked that little prop moment. I love seeing when the different trades really come to light in ways that you don't expect. It was just so subtle. And I don't know why I noticed it. I just saw Melanie and Lizzie fighting over the paper. Then on the back, I just saw the full page color ad for Aida. There they are at the
opera.
That's
a great detail. I'm actually going to have to go back in the episode and look at that again and catch that because I love stuff like that. When you can tell that a director is making sure to pay that much attention to detail, you know you have a good episode on your hands.
Yeah, and Lemke just didn't lay out props for one scene. She laid them out across many different scenes and many different characters and unrelated stories that were going on. So it was nice. And most people probably never would have even saw it. I was just watching with a more critical eye and it just jumped right out at me. So nice work, Tanya. Emmett, however, fat shames the Aida singer when he calls her Aida a lot.
The whole discussion they were having about Aida kind of would be like, that's not quite appropriate.
But instead, he runs off with Aida, the slave girl, who happens to weigh like 200 pounds.
You're not supposed to notice that.
How could I not notice. Her name should be Aida Lott.
I loved how Ted was there by himself in a tuxedo. It's like Ted has no friends. So
Well, he doesn't have any friends who are willing to go to the opera with him.
So he's at home. He just dresses up in his tuxedo and goes to the opera. I love that. I would
He's
do that.
A classy guy.
I know.
I love how George described him as the entrepreneur.
Yeah, right.
But you know, you are right. That is what he is. He is a shrewd businessman. Good for you, Ted.
It's something that I would totally do. If I want to go see something and nobody wants to go with me, I'm like, fine, I'll go.
Oh, I do that all the time. I go to movies. I go to the theater by myself all the time. I can't trust my friends. I will never forget it because when I first moved to Chicago, the Chicago Shakespeare Theater was doing this incredible production of Follies and everyone in town was talking about it. And I'm like, well, great. I want to go. And I tried to get some of my friends that I had moved here with to go with me. And they're like, yeah, we'll think about it. We'll go too. Next thing I know, tickets are sold out and I lost my chance. And yeah. I said, you know what? Screw that. I can't trust any of you bitches. I'm going to go by myself all the time. And I know then that I'll be happy that I saw what I wanted to see.
We have struck a chord.
Yes. Very strong feelings for people who waver on plans.
George was very charming when speaking with Ted and Schickel Hall. And then especially when Virginia Hammond Schickel, who was exactly what I thought she would be when she came over. And then Ted kind of started to get a little embarrassed with Emmett's potty mouth. But the funny thing is that Ted started that by saying, I packed away a lot of your pork. So I don't know why he's getting embarrassed about what his best friend Emmett was saying when in fact he started the whole thing.
Do you think that was a sort of like unintentional innuendo that he said?
I don't think so, because he looked mortified when Emmett owned Virginia Hammond. Let's listen to that scene real quick.
George and I are having a fabulous time. He's a wonderful companion.
And how did you meet? Are you his hairdresser, decorator, poodle groomer?
Actually, we met on the internet. I whack off on his website.
Yeah, you know what? Well, this champagne is delightful.
I'm the demon dick of .com.
How fascinating. He must pay you quite handsomely.
Oh, no. No, he doesn't pay me at all. I wouldn't take it if he did. The reason I'm with George is he gives spectacular head. A skill I'm certain he didn't learn from you.
Do you really think that Virginia Hammond Schickel would know what head is, though?
I don't know. All I know is I was here for Emmett letting her have it.
Yeah. It was great in the moment, but it was strange that Emmett felt bad about it when they were in the limo on the way home. He was afraid that he had accidentally re-banished George from Schickel Hall again.
Or embarrassed him in some way. And I love that George was not mad. He thought it was hysterical, and he probably got a kick out of someone standing up for him. And I think it showed a new leap in their relationship.
I still think the gap, though, is this is Schickel Hall, and George Schickel was afraid to go to Schickel Hall. So they could have at least named the venue something else, because he's a multimillionaire donor, so he's clearly financing a lot of that. He's got to show up at some point for events, right?
It would have made sense to call it Hammond Schickel Hall or something.
Hammond Hall?
Hammond Hall. Something to show that really that's the wife's territory that he is stepping into.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. Yeah, that would have been good.
And that's why he has such a fear of it.
Right, right. This coming out story was pretty enjoyable to watch. I liked it. I also found it plausible. So many storylines in Queer as Folk, I think, are just very implausible. But this one worked for me. I like the way that it was put together.
And we'll be right back to talk about the Law and Order portion of the episode. You're listening to Still Queer as Folk. And while we're on our break, make sure you give us a like, rate us on iTunes, give us a great review. We'd really appreciate it. So Debbie is coming out of the diner, doing her usual duties, and is about to throw out the trash. And what does she find in this dumpster?
Dumpster boy.
A literal dead body. And I actually really, I don't want to say liked, but I found it really effective. Let's go with that. I found it incredibly effective, her reaction to it. Because it wasn't hysterics. It wasn't something outlandish. It was like she didn't know what to do with herself. She didn't know if she needed to scream for help. Or you could tell that she was trying to come up with like the words. And it reminds me of, I think, a recurring dream or a nightmare that a lot of people have, where you feel like you're trying to scream, but no sound comes out. It was a very jarring moment that really set up the effect that this has on Debbie.
Yeah, the only thing that she managed to get out was, holy shit. I probably would have like screamed. Would have been like, ah! I mean, you open the dumpster, throw the garbage out, and there's a dead twink in there.
Exactly. And
that's horrifying.
So I found it rather refreshing that they found a different kind of, it was more frozen mm-hmm. kind of reaction.
Yeah, she kind of looked around like, did this just happen? Mm-hmm. Like, what is going on? And she was paralyzed with the fear of it. We do get a new character introduced here that becomes a regular on the show, and that's Detective Carl Horvath, played by Peter McNeil. He eventually appeared in 24 episodes of Queer as Folk. His IMDb page is a mile long, goes back to 1973. But the only show I've seen him in was Star Trek Discovery. But he has hundreds of credits.
Star Trek Discovery is the new Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't even know what character he played in that. I didn't remember seeing him.
Was he in heavy makeup or was...
I don't know. I'm going to have to go back and look. Do you think it was weird that Justin was just so into getting a look at Dumpster Boy when they're pulling him out, putting him in the bag? And
when the police were there and you know, treating it like a crime scene, I found it incredibly odd that I thought Justin was like behind the tape.
Yeah. I don't think there was tape.
And I was like, what is going on?
Like everybody's there.
Is no one trying to protect the crime scene? It made no sense exactly. to me whatsoever. That's where I was like, Detective Horvath is doing a terrible fucking job right now.
And the body was completely on display, which normally in like a murder scene like this, they will hide the body, not for like morals or anything, but because they don't want anybody to see, like, for example, what the victim's wearing.
Yes.
Because those are things that they can use in interrogations later. So it was a very dramatized version of, oh, look, there's a dead twink. Let's parade him through the parking lot of the mm-hmm. diner. So the staging and the writing was a little unrealistic there. Justin was just horrified, but he's just kind of bouncing around and looking and going, oh, ooh.
It was a little like a little kid in that moment.
Hey, you got a name, detective?
Looks like we got a Jane Doe.
What did you just say?
Cop talk.
You know, just because you found a body on Liberty Avenue doesn't give you the right to make fag jokes. The boy in the trash was somebody's son.
Yeah. I'm sure he made his mother proud.
Well, I am the proud mother of a gay son. And you are a homophobic prick.
Horvath used the term Jane Doe, and Debbie just lit up on that. Is Jane Doe like a homophobic slur?
Because it's clearly a gay guy. He's mocking him for being bi feminine in some way. Because clearly it's a man. You would say John Doe.
Yeah. I mean, Debbie just busted out. You're a homophobic prick.
Well, I think just because the unprofessionalism in that moment is what's really eating at her, is that there is a dead person, no matter what you might think about their personal lives, that is a dead person who matter to someone. How dare you? And I think that's what she was trying to get at.
Yeah, I don't think it was like all that different from like Law and Order SVU when Mariska Hargitay and Christopher Maloney and that butt of his. They're doing this every day.
Let's take a moment for Christopher Maloney's butt, please.
They're doing this every day. So they build up a certain tolerance to that particular story of the person, and they're doing their job, and they have a job to do, and they have different things that they need to accomplish while the scene is still active. So I get that kind of detachment from the dead person. I just didn't know why Debbie lit up on that particular remark so much, because you hear Christopher Maloney and Mariska Hargitay say similar things. Granted, these are fictitious characters, but
I don't think they ever say anything like that where it feels like it's malicious towards the victim, though.
Yeah, I mean, they have a certain amount of respect for it, but they also have a certain nonchalance around it. And I think that's maybe why I bumped on it, because Debbie just went ballistic on that particular
word. Right, because she's not part of that culture.
She's not on Law and Order SVU. Yeah, she's on Cagney and Lacey.
Exactly. So she's not part of that police culture that, you know, that's that kind of bullshit locker room talk, you know, that has come about where that's how we try and dismiss people who are upset by it.
The gang seemed entirely disaffected by it. And I remember a couple murders in Boys Town over the years, and it was a huge deal, as well it should be. So Boys Town, Chicago is essentially just a road in the middle of a residential neighborhood. So right down the main strip surrounding it, it's full of houses and alleys and apartment buildings and nowadays $1 million condos and $1 million single family homes. So it's a big deal when there's a murder in that mostly white gentrified area surrounded by a gay entertainment district. There was a serial killer like warning for a while, because ultimately it was proven that the two crimes weren't related. But for a period of time, everybody was worried about the Boys Town serial killer. I mean, people were scared. And I do remember at the time, my friends and I, like, I guess in a horny panic, we would always message each other where we were, like the address of the Trix house that we were going into at the time, just in case. It had that level of impact to it. So I started to relate to this story quite a bit because all of a sudden it was dangerous to hook up in Liberty Avenue.
I don't think that's something that's far off the path even today, especially now that we have, it's no longer the, oh, I picked someone up at the bar and I'm going to go home with them. Now it is like, we can go within 5 minutes of speaking to someone, we can meet up wherever we like and have our tryst. And some people could possibly never know where we went.
Totally.
I'm glad we're bringing up the way the boys seem to make light of it.
Did you see what he was wearing?
Leather pants, tank top.
Yeah, my theory is whoever killed him was making a fashion statement.
So whoever this demented aberration of humanity was who killed him, do you think they had sex first?
Hope so. It's always better to come before you go.
That is some real bullshit. Like, I had a moment where I was incredibly angry at these characters because of the way they were reacting to someone's death. Like, it was such a turnoff for the way that we spend so much time with these characters to then see how they made such light of the situation. So
they kind of show their age a little bit, though.
Oh, absolutely. So. And to have Debbie hear this, especially Brian, for Debbie to then talk about how disappointed she was in them.
Yeah, she snapped them right back into humanity.
What is the matter with all of you? A boy was found outside dead, stuffed in the garbage, like yesterday's mashed potatoes, and you're all making a joke out of it? Is that how little you think about his life? How little you think about your own? I expected more from you than that.
The Michael and Captain Astro story was, I think, weird, to put it mildly. There was an interesting parallel to Captain Astro dying from an intergalactic virus and Ben being HIV positive. So there's that angle. Then there's the dumpster twink. So I don't know what was going on with this story, but Michael was really wrecked by Captain Astro. Have you ever been that wrapped up in a fictional character that when they have an on-screen death that your entire life is wrecked?
Not my entire life. I'm sure in the moment I'm kind of inconsolable for like maybe 10 minutes, but then I move on because it's a fictional character.
Right.
I understand the impact that Captain Astro as a character had on Michael, and I respect that. I think the pedestal in which he put Captain Astro was a little much.
Yeah, this story was pretty overblown. For me, in the movie Philadelphia, when Andrew Beckett died, that kind of got to me for a little while. Mm. But at the end of the day, I knew that it's fiction. I mean, it's based on a true story, but ultimately it was fiction. And I wanted to look at that work and take something away from it and not go through like the steps of grieving with it.
That's something that the Normal Heart has for me. If you don't know The Normal Heart, it's a play by Larry Kramer that was written in the 80s. That is his response to how the AIDS epidemic was handled by the country, basically. And I've seen it 3 times. 2 different productions. There's also the TV movie that Ryan Murphy did on HBO. The first time I saw it, I was affected by it in a way that was, I was pissed off. I was angry. And this was also prior to me coming out. So I'm watching this gay story, knowing something about myself that I have not shared with people. And it's about people that I relate myself to, but not yet, all dying and no one caring. Then I see it in Chicago after now being out. And I had a very different reaction to it, to where I was by the end of the play. Remember, I knew exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. I was so emotionally inconsolable that it took a while for me to even get out of my seat.
Aww.
Like, I was like, I was straight sobbing for like 10 minutes Aww. After the show. And I saw it again and had the same reaction. So I understand how a story that, I mean, obviously, you know, Michael grew up with Captain Astro. And then to see Captain Astro killed by something that is such a, it's not even veiled. It's a very obvious, I feel like it was a little too on the nose of what killed Captain Astro, especially when we're given the information that people believed that Captain Astro was gay. But what was the name of his villain? Didn't have the name.
I don't know.
It had the name Fist in it. And I'm like, I feel like that was a little like, yeah, maybe he is kind of gay.
Yeah, this whole little arc arc just kind of seemed meaningless to the whole story. I kind of wish it wasn't even there. It didn't need to be there for the story. It did have a couple little nuggets in it, like when young Michael had to go back to the drugstore to admit that he stole a Captain Astro comic. It's something that gives a good basis to his morality now as an adult.
Debbie has a moment with Michael in the diner when she's lambasting the rest of the group for how they're reacting to the dead guy, and that he's trying to have this petition signed to bring back Captain Astro. And she's like, you care more about this fictional character than this poor guy that could have been any one of you. And I feel like the way she uses that, I think really shakes Michael up.
Yeah, because she had a point. And that Brian was wrong about it being okay for Michael to care about Captain Astro more than Dumpster Boy. This story was just so implausible. Professor Bruckner really schooled Michael about why nobody cared about both Dumpster Boy and Captain Astro.
Everything's the same. Business as usual.
What'd you expect?
That things would stop, you know, even for one night. That there'd be a protest or candlelight vigil, something.
They don't want to think about it. Or about gay bashing or AIDS or any of the other shit we all have to live with.
There was a couple things about this scene that I like, though. We're never quite sure if Michael is talking about Captain Astro or Dumpster Boy, so I like that you had to really think about it, because he always had these moments where you're not sure who he is really upset about, and I like that. I like that Captain Astro was kind of a proxy for Dumpster Boy. Through the story, Michael was kind of learning how to separate his lifelong fantasy with comics and real life, with Professor Bruckner leading the way. It was a nice scene. The one thing that I thought was weird is that Professor Bruckner carries a Zippo lighter with him at all times.
Why?
Yeah. Surely a man that that practiced Buddhism and does yoga and meditates smokes cigarettes? He just happens to have this very fancy lighter with him.
For their vigil.
Still a nice scene, though.
Yes.
Brian and Justin, this story only had a few minutes of airtime. They're stalking their prey in Babylon. That kind of rang a few bells for me, because my friends and I used to kind of do that same kind of catty thing. We'd sit off to the side and like pick people out or like rule people out.
That shit still happens today. Let's be honest.
I love it. Such fun, right? It seems like whenever they bring somebody back, though, Justin ends up topping.
Yes, because they pick up Dirty Blonde, who is also
Dirty Blonde Bottoms,
who is also credited as Todd. And I'm like, wait, is it like Todd as in like Todd in the back room, Todd?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's just like because he was like the body for that or what. But I also love that Brian, as they're having this threesome, he says, "You have great taste." And Dirty Blonde pulls up and says, "Oh, thanks. No, not you." And puts his head back down. I found that kind of funny.
I do like that Justin is, he's really like fully verse. He just loves to get fucked by Brian. So that's my take on his position.
Put up.
Brian did explain to Justin that the danger aspect of random hookups is really what makes them thrilling, better, more fun.
You came here not knowing what was going to happen. That was part of the thrill. That's what made you hard. You're hard now just thinking about it.
I like that. I related to that because there is something interesting and exotic about meeting a stranger and hooking up with them. I don't know what it is, but Brian spoke truth there.
I will not disagree with his thesis about hooking up with a stranger. What disturbed me, though, was the physical interaction that was happening as he was describing this.
Yeah, when he was like choking him out.
This was a moment to where I actually got uncomfortable watching. And I think it's because we're definitely in a time now where consent is such at the forefront that to watch that line sort of get blurred a bit was really disturbing to me to watch.
Maybe they already had the discussion about their own personal boundaries.
Oh, absolutely. But because we don't see that conversation
he's just like strangling him.
It was as if Dr.
Jekyll and Mr. Brian.
It was as if something was unlocked in Brian to see this Dumpster Boy.
Maybe it's designed to get Justin thinking that Brian killed him.
It was a little too
Brian.
It was
a little choked out the twink.
It was a little too American Psycho-y for me. I felt kind of ugh.
Well, ultimately in this story, Justin's the only one that really took a practical lesson from it, because as Brian's leaving Babylon with a trick that he doesn't know, who was actually very hot.
Trick of the night is what he's credited as.
Justin just jumps into the middle of it, but Brian goes anyway, as of course he would, and the two walk off into this red smoky alley that looked like hell.
And it was creepy as fuck.
Yeah.
And I think that was sort of the more thriller, suspense, maybe even horror aspect of this episode that really landed for me.
Well, it was another situation where we're left thinking, Brian rarely goes to somebody else's place. He usually hosts, or as we say in the UK, accommodates.
But that sounds so much more inviting than host. Accommodate.
So this scene I really liked because Out of Control by the Chemical Brothers was playing, and that's a very old song, but most people would recognize it. So it was a nice, dangerous song as Brian's going off into the mist. It was a good ending because the entire episode ended there. We get this danger feel from the murder of Dumpster Boy. It's not really a cliffhanger, but it leaves you wondering enough, like, did Brian just walk off with the murderer? Oh.
Next time on Queer as Folk.
Yeah. And that's it. So let's recap this episode. Timeliness. I gave this one a 4. Emmett and George finding something between them despite the age difference is, it's a timeless story. Match that up with Granny Faye and Vera's forbidden love story, and this episode holds up well, even though I had problems with the Captain Astro portion.
I think after discussing it, I'm going to bump this up to a 5. Ooh. And I think the big reason, and I know we described it as a runner, but the story of the Dumpster Boy and the manner in which we're still fighting today with the murder, especially of the trans community, that it has happened so often and it feels like it's treated as such an unimportant event, really stuck with me, and especially to try and get them to have the same weight of importance. Like, this should matter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're watching so many people get murdered and it feels like the police just don't give a shit. They're putting in like a
Jane
third. They're putting a third of the effort and they're cracking fucking jokes like that in front of people. It's one of those things that just like lights the fire under me that, yeah, really makes me think about, wow, 17 years later, and maybe it's because we're a more prominent community. We're not hidden as much anymore, but we are still treated like absolute shit, the people that are supposed to protect us.
Information accuracy. I give this one middle of the road 3. Only because nothing in the story really offended me in terms of being accurate then or now. It just didn't really try to push any limits, I guess. So I just gave it a middle of the road 3.
I gave it a 3 as well. And I think it's because, and this was something you had mentioned prior to us recording, is that Michael, as a business owner, should have known that there wasn't going to be another Captain Astro comic, because he would have planned it months in advance, or ordered months in advance. So for him to kind of discover in the moment that that's the end of Captain Astro didn't really make sense to me as much as for him as a fan of comic books, and also him as an entrepreneur of comic books.
For relatability, I gave this one a 5. I really liked this episode. Loved it, even. The older-younger love story, the forbidden love story, the dangers of hookups with strangers, and of course, the opera. They're all stories that made sense to me. Captain Astro didn't, but it was really just a metaphor for Dumpster Boy and Michael's inability to deal with the real world. So I really related to the stories here.
I'm literally in complete agreement. I think what affected me particularly was the story of Granny Faye.
Aww.
Like, that one like really got to me, because I think the fact that it we were getting bits of it, like we kept cutting back to that story and we're seeing that there's a whole journey happening with Mel and Lindsay, especially with Mel and Lindsay finally kind of getting the front part of the storyline here. I felt like I learned so much about Granny Faye and Vera just through the letters.
They need a spinoff.
Yeah. I want to know more. I would have loved to see the forbidden love business now.
Yeah. Versus just a simple storytelling of it.
And that is episode 10 of season 2. Priorities, please. Beat the time.
Next week, the entire gang pitches in to plan Lindsay and Mel's wedding.
It's a gay wedding.
And Emmett has finally saved enough money to buy butt implants.
That man has never skipped a leg day, so I don't know why he's buying butt implants.
His butt's great.
But we'll find out next episode. So that's episode 11 of season 2, The Wedding.
We are close to the jump the shark moment in this series.
Oh,
I'll tell you when it is. It's coming up, though, really quick. Thanks for listening to Still Queer as Folk. Please rate and review us on iTunes. It really means a lot to us and helps more people find our show.
Thanks for joining us this week. I'm Matt Dominguez.
And I'm Patrick Randall. We'll see you next week. Still Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez. Made with love in Chicago.